Hello, and welcome to Beyond the Balance Sheet. Once again, I'm your host, Michael Pasquale, obviously a financial advisor and partner within the Soteria Wealth Management team here at UBS Financial Services in New York City. You can reach me at michael.pasquale@ubs.com. Today's episode, we are honored to be joined by Mary Ellen Iskandarian, President and Chief Executive Officer of Women's World Banking, a global nonprofit organization dedicated to expanding women's economic opportunity through access to financial systems. Mary Ellen is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services, Inc., and the views she shares today are her own. In this episode, we continue to explore the theme of women's wealth and well-being, focusing on how women experience money, responsibility, and resilience across cultures and income levels, as well as what it truly means to build financial systems that support confidence, stability, and long-term well-being. So with that being said, Mary Ellen, thank you so much for joining us today on the Beyond Balance Sheet podcast.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Michael.
So let's get started. For our listeners out there, and for me too, since we've only recently had a chance to get to know each other, can you tell us a little bit about your background on yourself? Where did you grow up? What was the sort of early association with finance? And if you could give us a little bit of background on you to start, that would be great.
Sure. So I, as you mentioned in the introduction, I'm the president and CEO of Women's World Banking, which this month is celebrating our 47th anniversary. So we've been around for a very long time, which is, in the world of nonprofits, that longevity is pretty notable. And since our founding, we have always been dedicated to the proposition that all women need access to the full range of financial services, both to protect them, so for their security, for their resilience, but also to ensure their prosperity. Mm. We were sort of born in the early days of the microfinance movement. So that was a lot of, you know, who we grew up in, that really, when you think about it, revolutionary idea of banking very, very poor people and seeing pretty extraordinary repayment rates on very small amounts of capital. But around the time that I joined the organization, which I'm kind of stunned is now going on 20 years, the introduction of digital financial services really just blew up the whole idea of getting financial services to very poor people and how that would be done. And the very exciting thing is it drove the price point down dramatically. So the very small transactions, the small savings, the small loans, the small payments that poor people needed to make, they're just as economically and financially active as you or I, but they do it on smaller amounts, suddenly became viable financially. And to be very candid, the microfinance industry was a little slow to realize that, you know, it was going to be adapt or be eaten a little bit. They didn't see that digital could be an extraordinary way for them to expand their business, mm-hmm. to reach that last mile client. But if they didn't react, that, you know, it was really going to come to, you know, define the way that lower income people received financial services. Mm-hmm. And so that's the world we've really been living in since 2007 or so. And it's been just incredibly exciting to see how the outreach through cell phone banking, digital financial services, digital payments, and now we're even starting to look at stablecoin as a route into financial inclusion, has really just changed the whole dynamic about who gets to be a part of the financial system.
That's fantastic. Thank you. I'm fascinated on the stablecoin comment, by the way. So Mary Ellen, you've had a career that spans Wall Street, global development, nonprofit leadership, obviously. What is one part of your personal journey that has shaped how you think about women and money today? And then how did that lead you to sort of where you are today at Women's World Banking?
Yeah. You know, this is kind of one of my, you know, good Catholic girl, I'm always going to be paying penance for this because, you know,
Catholic guilt, I have it. Yeah.
I suspected Michael Pasquale might understand a little bit about that.
Yeah. Villanova, Notre Dame grad. Yeah.
Because I had a long career at the World Bank. Incredibly fascinating career. I got there, I'm dating myself here, but I got there just as the Berlin Wall was coming down. And so I spent the next 10 years working on basically either building from scratch or recreating or getting out from mothballs financial systems that really had just gone silent for the 70 years of communism. In the case of the former Soviet Union, when I started working in Russia, Ukraine, Georgia, Armenia, those countries really had never had financial services industries that were designed to serve clients. They were just really just kind of a storage place for your money up until that point. And I saw some amazing things that finance could accomplish. The realization in Eastern Europe that a bank could actually help you realize a dream was just this unheard of concept. But I honestly never had that experience of, if you make sure that the capital is going into women's hands and that women have some element of control over the money that they're earning, the money that's coming into the household, how dramatically the outcomes are. Dramatically different the outcomes are for that household. It didn't take me very long at Women's World Banking, I'm happy to say, but it took my coming here. And, you mentioned, a personal experience. It was my first trip to Africa for Women's World Banking. I went to one of our partner microfinance institutions, to their branch in Mombasa, the second largest city in Kenya. And they took me for a few hours drive outside of the city. And we met this woman that was running a very prosperous hardware business. Joyce Wafuko was her name. And when she told me her origins, it was just kind of hard to imagine because she seemed so thriving, mm-hmm. so confident. But her family, she and her husband had moved back to the town that they both came from, and there just weren't enough jobs. There just wasn't enough for them to really earn money from. So he had gone into the city. He'd become a policeman, and she still really needed to earn some money on her own. And so she started what she called a hardware store, because she saw that people were repairing and making changes to their home rather than buying new homes, sort of on the side of the road. And she showed me some photos of those early days. She had some loose nails and a couple of 2x4s and some tomatoes and some cucumbers and like little shack on the side of the road. No hardware store you ever imagined. But she was doing okay. She was selling product. And so she thought, let me go to the bank and try to get a loan. Wouldn't even talk to her. Wouldn't even have a conversation with her. So she stayed a little bit longer. She started trying to borrow some money from her family members and in order to expand the business. But that, that had its limits and they could only make so much available. She went back to the bank. The bank said, well, yeah, you've got a reasonable business here, but you need to pledge the entire business and the land that your business is on against the loan. That wasn't going to happen. She didn't want to have to pledge 130, 150 times as much collateral for this loan. And somebody told her about an organization called Kenya Women's Trust, which was a microfinance institution. They made her a loan, gave her a bunch of financial literacy and business skills training, and kind of the rest is history. She now, at the time I met her, which is close to 20 years ago now, she has a $3,500 revolving line of credit. She has a business that anyone would recognize as a proper
real hardware store.
Yeah, hardware store. She has put all of her siblings through college, her youngest sister through graduate school. All of her kids are going through secondary school looking at college, which is very common. That's what we see. That's what women mm-hmm. make sure their money goes into, is their children's education.
I was just going to ask that. I'm going to go off because I'm fascinated by that. And first off, back to your example, I find it fascinating that the microloan or the situation was, here you go. And oh, by the way, we're going to teach you as well. So it wasn't like, let's teach you first before we give you loan. It was like, okay, we're going to trust that this is going to work. And then we're going to teach. Like, do you find that's normal, or we need to do more of it that way? Or did she have to apply? How did she get that opportunity?
No, that's such a great question, because I think that's actually been a hallmark of success of a lot of programs that we've been involved in. Classroom financial literacy training, for the most part, really doesn't work with adults. There's been reams of literature on this subject, and there's some really clear case studies, clear indications that it's a very much a learning by doing thing. Mm-hmm. And so whenever we get involved with a financial institution and helping them design a product that will reach women and particularly low-income women, we always sort of embed the learning into the product. And you only get the larger loan if you've shown that you can do certain things. And the concept of compound interest is mm-hmm. just mind-blowing to a yeah. lot of people. And we found time and time again that women were more likely to go to the formal financial institution, were more likely to seek out a bank or a microfinance institution in order to have a safe place to keep their money, not yep. to have to save under the mattress or in the little cubbyhole in their business. The money was not safe. They were, you know, there were other people in the household and the family and the village that were keen to get their hands on that money. And so being able to put it in a safe place and have a distance between you and your home and your family and where the money was kept safe, if you could combine the savings with the opportunity to borrow if you needed it, that combination of savings and the ability to borrow in an emergency was such a yeah. powerful proposition. And that is really what sold an awful lot of people on banking services.
How are we doing in terms of getting that message out? That it's, if you're a young entrepreneur, particularly in underdeveloped or poorer countries, don't keep it at home. Trust the banking system, or at least trust the local banking system. Here's examples where your point about compounding of interest. It's, we do waterfalls for very, very wealthy individuals and when we do their financial plans. Just the power of sticking to a plan, what that does longer term is so powerful. Moving it back to this microcosm of the bank will keep your assets not only safe, but they'll grow. And then you'll have the opportunity to take leverage on that and leverage on your business. And how are we doing with that process in terms of getting that message out?
It's another great question. I think, again, cell phone technology has done a lot to foster that idea of keeping the money out of cash, first of all, and in a place of deposit. And you see, particularly in Africa, you're seeing really large, I mean, probably not always safe amounts of money that people keep on their phone, that they're keeping in their mobile money account. But that idea of separating it from the household, placing it for investment with a financial institution is increasingly understood by the people that we're working with.
That's great. Let's go back to the education point. I love that. Mm-hmm. So you found that as women become, if not wealthier, at least have more disposable income, what they're doing is they're, maybe I would invest more and more and more. They're actually using it for education, for family and things like that. Is that something that's been pretty universal that you've seen?
Yeah. Yeah. Again, the literature is, you know,
the
there's some things.
Over
yeah,
men.
There's so, some things.
Another example
that just come through loud and clear. Women will prioritize spending on three things, or when the household decision is in their hands, they'll prioritize three things. First and foremost, as I said before, is the education of their children. Secondly, is healthcare for the entire family, and making sure that everybody has access to a doctor if one's needed. Unfortunately, what we've also seen is that women will deprioritize their own health in every situation other than pregnancy. And so we've actually made a lot of headway in getting more women into health insurance products by driving them around prenatal care, delivery, postnatal care. That's a time when women, a lot of the women we're talking to, are particularly receptive to healthcare messaging and the investing in insurance. And then the third thing that we find women are much more likely to spend money on when it's their decision are incremental changes to their households. The move from a dirt floor to a wood floor, or from a thatch roof to a wooden roof, may not sound like very much, but is an enormous change and is one that we saw time and time again, women prioritizing that expenditure. And as it turns out, particularly the dirt floor change, that has huge health impacts, because you think about, you're walking on dirty, dusty floors, the respiratory health impacts of that are really enormous. And you just are improving the family's health outcomes immediately
Dirt, what's the conversion from? It's dirt to a, what type
just,
of
floor? Just stone or wood.
Just a stone or wood. I'm writing down those points. Those are awesome. Do you think that is apropos to not just those regions, but also to women everywhere? That maybe not the dirt to the stone floor, but the prioritization of the family and health and education to the detriment of their own? To an extent, because they're spending their time and their incremental resource and their incremental money taking care of others. I mean, I know I see it from the women in my life. That's, you nailed it with those three points. Obviously, a little different, and you know, living in a wealthy suburb
But I think I think it's part of why I've stayed in this job as long as I have is that while my initial motivation was around economic development, the way women spend their money, use their money, think about their role and the way they prioritize their investments is so similar just across the socioeconomic spectrum. But the other piece of it, I think that we're, I think as a global society, we're just going to have to reckon with is that caregiver role that women play. Women everywhere spend more hours per week than men do on family caregiving responsibilities. And it's a major barrier to greater women's labor force participation in many of the countries that we're working in. And it's a real issue here in the US and other developed countries. You know, when France instituted the crèche system where you can take, you know, preschool age children to a safe, affordable, healthy childcare, you saw women's labor force participation just skyrocket really beyond even where it is in the US, even today. So that whole issue of who's taking care of the kids, who's taking care of the elder parents, that's still very live in our culture. And it works for some things and for some people, but it's also a brake on economic growth, on labor force participation, on many of the things that, you know, in an economy where growth is slowing, we really need to be thinking about addressing.
No. I know, at least from my own personal experiences, that burden continues to be carried by the women in my life. And I don't even know if it's intentional. It's almost subconscious for them, where they just feel that it's their obligation or they're, I don't know if it's, if there's joy in it per se, but it's almost like an obligation. Like I have to do that. That's my priority. And I don't know how you change that mindset. And maybe you don't, maybe it's men that are just stepping up and doing more and more, or your France example, just creating opportunities where you can do both, where you can increase labor participation rates while also making sure that your kids are safe and they're being well taken care of.
Tell you about a company. So we've gotten to be very, very good at how you sell financial services and other services to women. That's just become, we understand women, where our market research is quite good. And we were approached by a company here in the US that had a product, basically it was an employee benefit product that they sold to companies who executives could gain access to this benefit if they had elderly parents. They would take care of sort of all of, you know, moving them into assisted living or getting them to doctor's appointments or whatever the care responsibility, but always for the older adult. And they were finding that the majority of the clients that the companies that they were working with were offering it to male employees who were turning it down because they just didn't think it was a benefit that meant much, only to discover that their wives were like, why did you turn that down? Because the wives were doing it for both their parents and the husband's parents. So this company had actually come to us, like, help us market sort of past the male employee to his spouse. And how do you reach the woman with that product where there really is real value, that it would take a genuine burden off of her plate, to your point. So I think some of it is where there's a blind spot, you don't see it.
When you think about the financial system as a whole, how prepared is it, or are we for women to now become these primary stewards of wealth? We've already talked about outdated assumptions. Are we still operating on those, number one? And then what excites you the most about women holding more wealth? And then what concerns you in that type of scenario as well?
This is such an exciting moment. What's very interesting, and I'm not sure this part of the data always gets parsed, the initial beneficiaries of this huge transfer are going to be older women. It's going to be, you know, the passing of the male spouse. And so that part of the business, the financial industry is utterly unprepared for that. Yeah. We see the most recent data I've seen is that 60% of women will leave their wealth advisor within a year of their husband's passing because they never felt that they were being talked to. They were never included in the financial decisions and they will take their money elsewhere. So that initial transfer, we really got to get in gear. We know that, you know, the preponderance of wealth advisors are men. I have no problem with men providing those advisory services. I'm a big believer that representation matters and more women wealth advisors is a good thing. And they do have a different take on how they approach women clients. But this is not, you don't have to completely get rid of half of your workforce. This is something that, you know, male wealth advisors absolutely can learn, even if it's just about those conversations that you're having with the couple while both spouses are there. In terms of the next gen stuff, though, I think that's where we have maybe a little bit more runway, a little bit more time, but I think the changes are going to need to be as profound. We do see that next generation is much more keenly aware of sustainability, investing alongside their values. It's not just lip service. That does appear to be where they're orienting their investments. They are, many of them, digital natives, so they're much more comfortable with online information. So the in-person delivery of financial advice, you're going to really have something important to tell them. Between online and AI, you know, the basics are going to be taken care of. So I think the more bespoke portfolio management techniques are what you're going to have to be able to sell to next gen. I was in Zurich a couple of weeks ago, and I was seated at a dinner next to a very young new CEO of a bank in Switzerland who had a fascinating conversation. They had made a strong pivot, had really built up a business in crypto custodian services and custodial services. So doing a lot of due diligence on the cryptocurrency and whether the counterparties were good counterparties, whether the coins were holding their value, whatever. And he said the only reason they did that was that they found in their next gen wealth advisory conversations, the next generation of kids didn't even want to talk to them if they didn't have a crypto capacity. So I think we're going to have to get out of either our comfort zones or our assumptions about what wealth management constitutes if we really want to cater to the people who are going to be inheriting as well.
That's great. And I think we've seen a lot of that. We, in conjunction with our symposium around women's wealth and well-being, we also do an emerging gen symposium. This year, we're going to be doing it the same day. And it's been great. We're probably 2/3, 1/3 women versus men in the emerging gen symposium. No surprise. They ask the toughest questions and are way more into it. But that's so exciting as a father of two daughters to see that, you know, that, and it's to your point, the things that really resonated were the digital Bitcoin, you know, the ease of use of your online. But when we went to just plain vanilla paying your bills, managing your own cash flow, managing a balance sheet, your own personal balance sheet, I mean, it was just the questions were phenomenal. And then when we talked about buying a home, that was awesome. We had saved that for like the last 30 minutes. It was last year's symposium. We could have gone for 2 hours. The questions were phenomenal about down payment, what do you need, leverage, what loan's good, when should I refi, should I do 30 over 5, what's interest only, what's adjustable rate? I mean, really, really great questions. And you just sort of think 24, 25, 26-year-old young adults would know these answers. They don't. No, they don't. They've not been exposed to it. And so that's where I think to your point, First of all, that's a scary number, the 60% you mentioned about the generation. So in our models, we model men living to about 89, 90. We model women living to about 93, 94. That's what the demographics would tell us for somebody that's, say, 50 right now. You know, that 4, 5, 6, maybe 10-year gap is the spouse. Data tells us that it's going to be the woman that's going to have that opportunity then to not only inherit the wealth, but grow the wealth. And if you're not spending the time, as what we always do when we do a brand new financial plan, if it's with a man, we say, well, we'd like to have your spouse on the line. If it's a woman, we'd say, we'd like to have your spouse on the line to do the FGA. And a lot of times say, no, I'll explain it to her later. We're like, no. Please have him or her on the line. If they decide they don't want to listen and they don't want to interact, that's fine. But to do our first initial meeting, which is a good hour of time where we really walk through your operating cash flow, your balance, your budget, your liquidity, your needs, your longevity, your legacy, et cetera. If you're not having both spouses, sometimes that's an alarm bell that goes off in my head when somebody's like, no, I don't want to do that. And hopefully we're moving more and more to the side where it's a relationship that they're developing with the wealth management teams, both of them, as a couple and as individuals. We love that when a spouse will reach out just on their own and say, can I have some time? And I want to learn. And we'll spend the time to actually educate them. And it's not just women, it's men too that really, you know, reach out more and more. So hopefully it's something that's changing. Anyway, I went off on another tangent. Can we talk a little bit about resilience? You often speak about resilience. What actually builds resilience for women, not only financially, but also emotionally and socially, especially during these times of transition that you've experienced, you know, in your role?
I do suffer a little bit from the, you know, when all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. So I do tend to see things through the lens of finance, but I don't think of money as only money. Money is about security and the ability to make choice and a certain amount of freedom. So it makes sense that financial resilience can get into all of those other, you know, sort of mental and physical areas of resilience. Certainly in the world that we're living in right now, that Women's World Banking is helping design solutions for, climate shocks are a very real thing, and they are often falling disproportionately heavily on women. And so a whole combination of financial tools, savings, insurance, credit, are all important to getting out ahead of the shock and then responding to it. But there are also things like we're seeing throughout Asia, extreme heat is just a terrible, terrible health emergency. And women are more affected at lower temperatures by extreme heat and in much more serious ways. And, you know, God forbid they're pregnant, you're already starting to see miscarriage rates start to creep up in countries that have severe heat issues. But there are also an increasing number of sort of non-financial solutions. You're seeing early warning systems coming in place. You know, it's going to be whatever unhealthy temperature in 3 days, go out and do your shopping now. Or if you own a business, you know, stock up now so that you're not out in the heat of the day and hot in the hot sun. You're not sending your kid to the playground in that very, very extreme heat. We're doing some really fascinating work in rural India in 3 different states, not necessarily only agricultural. So India is such a vast country that you can have actually very large sized towns and still think of it as rural. We're finding that women's businesses are losing on average 11% right off the top from climate. Either the stores
What is that 11% a measure of?
Let's give an example of a dairy business. So woman has...
So is that it's a top line?
Yes.
It's a revenue
she's
number?
She's losing 11% of her revenues either she doesn't have cold chain. Some of it is as simple as she doesn't have a shed to put over the cows that she's got for her dairy business. You asked about resilience, which is the whole range of both financial and physical assets that she doesn't have access to protect her and her business and her family from the heat, from flood, from the climate shock.
That's awesome. You're accommodating, that's where we're coming in to fill that need. Can we talk a little bit about, I know it's interesting to you, it's interesting to everybody, it's fascinating for everyone in the world right now, but where does technology and AI and what role will that take in your mind in shaping access and outcomes? And where do you see opportunities with all the change that we're experiencing in your world? I'm an optimist by nature, so I'm hopeful that you're going to say something that it's actually helpful for your business. Whereas I think in my business and some other businesses, it's a threat. It can be a threat. Whereas I think some of the areas that you are, I would think that we could leverage technology in such a greater extent for the outreach. But I'm fascinated to hear how AI technology play a role in your day-to-day and your outlook on that.
I can ease your concern. I see, you know, it is very exciting. It is all about, it is largely about possibility. You know, it's as simple as the story that I always relate is India had one of the biggest gender gaps in ownership of smartphones, well over 30% difference between men owning a smartphone and women owning a smartphone.
So this is pre-COVID.
This is pre-COVID.
A 30% gap.
More than. So
men were 90, women were 50?
Right.
Or 80, 40, or whatever the, you know, wow. Right.
COVID comes, first lockdown, the government makes the first round of relief payments payable only to women and only digitally. Within like 3 weeks, you saw 25 million new bank accounts all opened by women only digitally. And overnight, you saw a cultural norm that had been so restrictive and had governed so much about who could and couldn't get access to technology just sort of swept away. And I'm really happy to say and been very impressed by the responsiveness of the Indian government to keeping those women.
I was going to say, has
included.
That's continued.
Very much
and
so.
What was the reason for the gap? Is that a cultural thing? Is that a family thing where the man said, I own the phone, you don't? That seems very much off.
Yeah, there were a lot of like family concerns about certainly young women. If she's got a phone, she can be talking to boys, she could be getting herself in that kind of trouble. Similarly, if a woman in the village was seen talking on a phone in the middle of the afternoon, you know, everybody was curious, like, what's she doing? Who's she talking to? What's that about? It was just seen as a sort of culturally not cool for women to have access to the technology, implying access to like a wider world or that they could be preyed upon by men. And not to say that that doesn't exist in some parts, but that has been dramatically reduced as more and more of Indian life is now conducted online. But specific to your question about AI, so I guess my point being, I'm very, very hopeful about the foreseen and unforeseen wonderful impacts that access to technology can have for women. On AI, I similarly feel that women have had such difficulties gaining access to finance for their businesses, for their educations, you name it, any of the things that people would want to secure a lump sum of capital for. And so if they do get access, like the woman I was telling you about in Kenya, collateral requirements have been so difficult for women. So many of the countries we work in, women are not allowed to own capital and own land in their own name or not able to inherit property. So there's just so much that stands between them and that capital. So if with AI, as you're building algorithms that look at all sorts of other things to determine creditworthiness. And that is the way creditworthiness is now being determined through algorithms. That has real potential for women who've been shut out to be included. Mm-hmm. But the downside and where, I mean, we've just got to get on this immediately because women are so invisible in the data. Women across the world and across socioeconomic strata are much less likely to do digital payments, to do digital transactions. That digital footprint is what's going into those algorithms. And so it's both a question of getting women's data included, but also maybe asking when you've got an algorithm that's looking at making credit decisions and you know you might not have as robust a representation of women, just making sure there's like a double check on that algorithm. We were brought in by a digital lender to look at their algorithm. Did we see any bias? And quite frankly, we didn't even get to the algorithm. Their funnel, their online application asked, this was in India, asked women for documentation that frankly women don't even get. They're just, you know, birth certificates and different kinds of documentation, personal documentation that women just didn't have. So they weren't even making it into the funnel to be rejected by the algorithm. they weren't even getting past that. Then when they did, we saw really superior or at the very least equal performance on the loans that were ultimately made to the women business owners.
That's great.
If I think about financial institutions, so if financial institutions truly want to serve the next generation of women wealth holders, what is the mindset shift that we need to experience now and potentially in the near term? We don't have a lot of time before we have this generational transfer really picking up steam. So what would be the most immediate things you'd like to see from some of our financial institutions in this regard?
I think it really is, you know, it's sort of the flip side of what I would say to that young woman who might be inheriting wealth or earning money on her own. The idea of being a really conscientious consumer of those financial services. And I think, you know, the points you were making earlier about financial literacy, understanding, it really is up to you to make sure you understand how your money is invested, where it could be invested, how it could be used in service and frankly, in detriment. We see, unfortunately, women are subject to harassment online in all forms, both financially and otherwise. You know, we do a lot of work with central banks. They are clamoring for consumer protection that focuses directly on women's financial fraud and harassment. So it's really a two-way street. Mm-hmm. The financial institution has to be very much, you know, do no harm and being and taking care of their consumer, but you've got to be a smart consumer and take some responsibility for understanding, you know, what's being done with your money. I also really encourage people to look at who's in the leadership of your insurance company, of your bank, of your wealth management firm. It really does make a difference. There's so much data that, you know, if you're a woman-led business, the single most contributory factor on whether or not you're going to get a venture capital investment in your business or a loan to your startup business is whether there's another woman on the investment committee that's considering your pitch. And so checking out how well represented you are in the leadership of the organization. I don't think we've talked about so far. We have an impact investment asset management company, and we've seen across our portfolio that it is the companies that don't just have women at the board or at the senior level, but all the way through the business that are most consistently able to attract more women clients and hold on to retain those women clients.
Yeah, that's great. Unbelievable stats. One last question. So to wrap things up, we like to ask this question of all our guests. Beyond the balance sheet, what does wealth and well-being mean to you? And I think for you, Mary Ellen, this is maybe more apropos than for most because you're surrounded by this all the time and about creating capital situations for people that are desperately in need of it. And so when you think of the wealth component and the well-being component, what does that mean to you?
For me, wealth means choice, or money means choice, and you being able to make choices. It's not a coincidence that the word empowerment, which is like such an overused, underexplained word and doesn't ever really mean anything, but the definition that has always resonated with me is, you know, a woman is empowered when she can choose where she wants to live, who she wants to marry, when she wants to marry, when she wants to have children, if she wants to have children, if she wants to extend her education, if she wants to go to work, if she wants to form a company rather than taking on employment. Those sorts of choices are what money allows you to do. And that is about both financial well-being, but it is also about your soul and who you show up as in the world.
That's great. Well, we're about out of time. So, Mary Ellen, I just want to say thank you. That was great. I learned so much and really looking forward to getting this out in the domain and having more and more people hear your story. really lovely experience getting to know you. I'm really looking forward to seeing you again soon. And hopefully we can collaborate on either another podcast or maybe a symposium or something like that.
Well, that would be super.
Thank you for joining us on Beyond the Balance Sheet. I'm your host, Michael Pasquale. At Beyond the Balance Sheet, we explore the stories, strategies, and insights shaping the future of wealth, well-being, and legacy. To keep up with our latest conversations, please subscribe to our podcast and share it with a friend who might enjoy these discussions. If you have any questions, feedback, or topics you'd like us to cover, please reach out to me at michael.pasquale@ubs.com. Until next time, keep looking beyond the balance sheet.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.